should have said that 5 minutes ago.
I tried.
No, you're going to finish now. And it better be good.
I got to go party, Dad.
You were on your last point of attention.
Is she ready?
Which you now have from us.
All right. Well, basically, I've been in Lane County practicing 18 years. I have never had a hung jury. I can't say that about other counties. Now, the reason for that, in my opinion, is that lawyers are entitled, as are the litigants, to have all the questions asked on voir dire if they want the luxury of it. We can compel justice, if you will, to the point where we destroy the system. Because people, the hung juries are because people don't get all the facts, the opportunity to bring them in. Okay, why am I saying all this? Cases tried per judge is not the statistic that I think we ought to be looking at per se. I'm saying it's because the judges are available to handle the show causes, because the judges will take the sanity hearings. They'll hear those kinds of things when the need to be heard. And how many times have you taken depositions where the other lawyer starts to rattle a little bit and you say, I want a judge. We'll decide a judge. I have never called Lane County Circuit Court that somehow or other I haven't been able to say they'll sandwich me in. And I've been in other counties where I have not had that luxury. Now, I'm not talking about, all I'm saying is that maybe the filing statistic as related to the cases tried has correlation to the ultimate thing of justice, because when you're in that courtroom, you get all of the judge. He isn't sitting there waiting for you or shoving you or pushing you out of his courtroom so that he can get another case in. That's my point. And I have never felt that way in Lane County. Justice, that's all. Thank you. I want to congratulate this committee on your attention this afternoon. I've been watching you, and I'm amazed. Maybe it's because it's early in the session, but everybody's been paying a lot of attention, and I appreciate that. Thank you for
How do you expect lawyers to behave when they're listening to judges?
Thank you for waiting so long.
Yes, we appreciate your patience. Sorry it's been all afternoon, but we wanted to take those three bills really as a group, and we're sorry it took so long. Thank you both for coming up.
Thank you.
Anything further? Anybody who says yes, we'll get this adjourned until tomorrow at 1:30.
Judiciary Committee, January 27th, 1:30 p.m., room 354.
House Subcommittee, Judiciary is in session. Clerk will note those present. Representative Blumenauer is excused. First bill on the hearing agenda today is House Bill 2164. And first witness is Tex Scheibe. Tex. Okay. By way of ground rules, I've been informed that there's some people here that want to testify on 2167, which is not on the agenda, and we will not entertain any testimony on that because to do so would be in violation of the open meetings law. We have not given 24 hours prior notice on that. I'd also ask all witnesses to state their name and address for the record, and those witnesses testifying on the same bill to try to avoid cumulative testimony where possible and to keep the remarks brief and to the point.
Mr. Chairman, could I advise the committee of something with respect to this bill before Mr. Shively is involved? I don't think he'd mind. If you would, I'll withdraw the request.
Mr. Shively, do you mind if he...
No, I don't. That's fine.
Okay.
I was just had it before I got up here. I got to walk back now.
Stay here, Jack. This won't take a minute. Mr. Chairman, Michael Gillette from the Attorney General's Office. With respect to House Bills 2164 and 2166, they were intended when introduced to be part of a package which included 2167. And quite frankly, my feeling is that the three bills ought to be heard in the same session by the same subcommittee. I don't think it would be of great value for you to hear two today and the third at some future time. More than that, Mr. Shively, who just found out about two of these bills last night, has discussed with me briefly some concerns he has. He has appeared with respect to firearms legislation in the past, and I found some of his objections in the past to be cogent. I haven't had a chance to discuss the thing with him, and I have a feeling the committee's work would be furthered if we had a chance to talk before the committee was stuck with hearing testimony from either of us concerning these measures.
Is there Mr. Paulson in the audience? Mr. Paulson, you're the only other witness on these three bills. Do you have any objection to having them not heard at this time and having the third bill included in at some later date?
These are of a great deal of interest to the Four Wheel Drive Club.
Ask them if you would come
up. To the Oregon Wildlife Federation.
Would you come forward, please?
I am Paul Paulson, 1547 Southeast Elliott Avenue, Portland, Oregon. I have barely had a chance to see these bills. They're of a great deal of interest to the Four Wheel Drive Clubs of Oregon, to the Oregon Wildlife Federation, and to the United Sportsmen of Oregon. And I do think that we should have a better chance to look at them and to discuss them with the Attorney General's office first.
I take it then you have no objection to having these heard all three together at a later date.
Yes, with plenty of announcement, because I don't care how well it is, the subject is going to get a lot of people terribly upset.
Okay. Is there anyone else that's here to be heard on 2164 or 2165? 2066, excuse me.
I would like to reiterate to you what I have here. I already talked to Mr. Myers about it. He told me to tell you this and then have some copy. He can bring a copy back to him. He has some copies made so all the committee will get them.
Okay. Are there any objections from any members of the committee to having these matters set over so all three bills could be heard at the same time?
I have one objection. 2167 is going to be a very long, dragged-out bill. It's going to be a very controversial bill, and I would like to suggest that that be heard itself, but I think you will have between 500 and 600 people down here to testify. Really. 67 is going to be very controversial due to the fact it deals with a loaded pistol, doing away with a loaded pistol in a car in the state of Oregon.
We will take that up with the chairman of the committee. At this point in time, we're only deciding whether or not the bill should be heard at a separate time. And
I talked to him about it this morning, but he told me to go ahead and give you either get a copy made of this, so each one of you get a copy of it, or read it off to you, whatever.
Okay. Hearing no objections from the committee, already.
Would you ask him to give me that?
Give you what?
His statement.
Okay, this is for the record on these bills.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll accept that as evidence at this time.
You want me to give it to you?
Give it to the committee clerk.
Okay, fine. If you see it, all members of the committee get a copy of this.
They will.
I have 66 and 67 both on there.
Okay, we'll move on to our next item.
Mr. Chairman, am I to understand that the bill concerning the loaded guns will not be heard now in the vehicles?
No, that is not true. What is going to happen is we have decided at this time not to hear 2164 and 2166, and those bills will be heard at a later time. 2167 will also be heard at a later time. And the only reason we would not hear 2167 today is because it wasn't on the printed agenda, and we would be in violation of the open meetings law. And for that reason, we are carrying those two bills over that I mentioned, 2164 and 2166, until a later time, but they will be heard also, as will 2167. Okay. Next bill is to be heard is 2165. Mr. Gillette.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, again for the record, my name is Michael Gillette with the Attorney General's Office. House Bill 2165 is a proposal to prohibit the prescribing of dangerous drugs by physicians except in good faith and in the course of medical practice. The need for this measure was discovered about a year ago when a matter arose in Southern Oregon in which an individual died as a result of an overdose of dangerous drugs which had been given by a physician when the evidence indicated the physician knew very well that the individual was simply hooked on the drugs, and in fact the drugs were not needed for any medical purpose. If the death had occurred due to an overdose of narcotics under similar circumstances, the physician would have been subject to prosecution for a felony, and we thought that we could prosecute him here too. However, the district attorney in question had a hard time finding a statute which worked, and so he phoned me and I searched, and there isn't one. We feel that there needs to be one, and this is it. The language which is used is an exact parallel to the language in the statutes which now forbid the prescription of narcotics without accepting good faith and for medical necessity.
What statute is that?
I was afraid you'd ask me that because it's Representative Lombard, I did not bring my notes with me and I can't figure it out. I just realized about 5 minutes ago I was going to be asked and I can't recall. As I recall, it's in ORS chapter 477. But in any event, it is in the chapter which relates to narcotics.
Can you give us the present language of is there any present language
regarding this problem?
Right.
There isn't any.
Any other questions by members of the committee? Representative Fugas?
Mr. Gillette, is it not possible to give, let's say, an individual, and I realize this is not the narcotic statute, but maybe it could apply, my question is going to be couched in terms of the narcotics statute. Don't you think it's possible to have a physician in good faith prescribe, and in the course of his medical practice, prescribe for, let's say, a repeated client or a patient to narcotics that would result in the death of that person through perhaps improvident use, and then translate this to the, I don't know, some barbiturates or something, which I understand you intend to cover with this?
Right. The answer is yes, but I don't, Representative Fugas, but I don't understand what it has to do with the purpose of this measure. This measure speaks to a situation where it is not done in good faith and is not medically necessary, and the state would have to prove both of those elements beyond a reasonable doubt.
Representative Lombard?
I think, though, Mr. Gillette, that the, if I could rephrase the concern that Mr. Fugas, Representative Fugas may have, is one that I did, and I was curious if anybody else in the committee had that problem, and that's with this wonderful term, in good faith. Do we have any interpretive decisions, and that's why I asked you on the reference to the narcotic statute, do we have any interpretations, court interpretations of good faith in this context that would make us feel a little more comfortable?
The phrase in good faith has been subject to court interpretations hundreds of times, not in connection with the state's narcotic statute, but it means exactly the same thing it would mean in any other legal circumstance. It's not a problem in terms of being able to give a jury an instruction with respect to what it means, because there's all kinds of law around on it. The narcotic statute itself has never been construed with respect to the meaning of that phrase, but there's no doubt in my mind as to what instruction would be given, be the same one given to a jury with respect to the meaning of the phrase in good faith in any case, common law or under a statute in which the phrase is used. I don't think it's a problem from a legal definition standpoint.
Any further questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
John Ewelling from the OMA.
Good the record, my name is John Ewelling of the Oregon Medical Association. We wish to go on record as publicly supporting House Bill 2165. When I showed it to our priorities committee, they felt comfortable with the language, and they certainly supported the intent of 2165, and that is if a physician is prescribing incorrectly and not in good faith, that we would support having criminal charges brought against that physician.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There's a gentleman, I can't read your writing, from the Kaiser Foundation.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Allaby, represent Kaiser Foundation, Health Plan of Oregon. We concur with OMA. We support the measure, the general concept of the measure.
Any questions from the committee?
Would you ask me how to spell his name?
Could you spell that for the record, please?
Your name?
Gary Allaby. The Gary spelled G-E-R-Y. The Allaby is spelled E-L-L. I-B-E-E. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Ellaby. Okay, our next bill is 2168. Mr. Gillette, I believe you're first up on that again. Yes, Mr. We'll take action on the bills as in the form of subcommittee recommendation at the end of all the bills. Testimony of the bills.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I'd like to clear up something procedurally. I'm afraid that I'm going to be appearing here from time to time, and I'm sure more than most members of the subcommittee would care to think about. Do you want me to identify myself each time at what hearing? I don't suppose it's necessary, really, is it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you. Never remember from session to session whether that does any good or not. House Bill 2168 changes one word in the statute, and doubtless on the basis of that change alone will generate a great deal of disagreement on the part of people who represent criminal defendants and people who prosecute them. The purpose of the measure is to deal with a situation in which a criminal defendant takes the stand to testify, but he merely testifies on examination by his counsel to the following. Your name is John Jones? Yes, it is. Are you married? Yes, I am. Do you have any children? Yes, I have 14. Are you a scoutmaster? Yes, I am. Do you go to church? Yes, I do. And there'll be a recitation of a history of outstanding service in the war and a few other things of that nature, all of which lead one to the conclusion that the person is of sterling quality. And then the defense counsel says no further questions. Under those circumstances, he may only be cross-examined by the district attorney with respect to what he testified to. The defense counsel is then free to comment to the jury that we had nothing to hide, our client took the stand. When in fact, under the statute as it now exists, we cannot ask him about the facts and circumstances which tend to show he's guilty of a crime, anything from homicide down to a very minor misdemeanor. Because of the limitation in the statute. It's a marvelous tactic. It isn't used very often, but when it's used quite effectively by an imaginative or courageous defense attorney, and quite frankly, it's a silly anomaly in the statute. A defendant who takes the stand is deemed to have waived his constitutional right with respect to being examined concerning the crime. There's absolutely nothing we can do because of the statute. And I would submit the statute ought to be consonant with the Constitution. That is, once a defendant takes a stand, he's subject to being cross-examined about those facts which tend to show that he's a crook. This statute, essentially, is one of the survivors of the gamesman theory of criminal trials rather than the search for truth process.
Any questions from the committee? Mr. Frobka?
Nick, my first question was whether there'd be any constitutional problems at all. I guess you negated that. There are none, as far as you know.
There aren't. As soon as the defendant takes the stand in the trial, he's waived his constitutional privilege against being required to testify. That's That is the act of waiver, taking a stand. He's done it with advice of counsel, but the entire constitutional discussion is over.
Okay, can you give us any information on the situation in other states? Is this law really anomalous and unique to Oregon, or
Dennis, I don't know. I did not try to find out. The anomaly seemed to me to stand by itself, and I did not check the standards of other states. The concept of limited cross-examination, however, in the civil context, is not at all unusual, as you're aware. So that the idea of limiting cross-examination to the scope of direct isn't unusual. But it's the peculiar situation that arises with respect to a criminal defendant where he could both say he took a stand and at the same time he kept anybody from examining him with respect to what's really at issue. That's a little frustrating. And in a civil case, you'll recall that if you want to get at the guy who doesn't want to testify on his own behalf or wants to limit it, you can call him as a witness yourself. In a criminal case, we cannot. So it's always possible in other contexts to get at that problem. In the criminal context, it is not.
Further questions? Representative Dugas?
I've learned in the short time that senior Mr. Gillette, to respect your knowledge of the law, but is this an absolute direct conflict with the Constitution of the state of Oregon? Is that your statement?
No.
Say kind of an inference?
The statute as it's now drawn is neither in conflict with nor in agreement with the Constitution. The statute is just different to the Constitution. The constitutional rule, both in Oregon and federally, is that a defendant cannot be required to take the stand, nor can he be required in any other way to give evidence against himself.
But once he
takes the stand under the Constitution, he has waived that right.
Under
both the state and federal constitutions, the right's waived when he takes the stand. But the difficulty lies in the fact that even after we've taken care of the constitutional problems, we've still got the statute lying there, which says he may not be examined.
Well, the question I have, Mr. Chairman, is if this is in conflict with the Constitution, wouldn't the Constitution prevail?
No, the Constitution doesn't require that a defendant testify. The state's perfectly entitled, if it wishes, to accord more protection by statute than the Constitution mandates. The state can always do that. There are a lot of statutes around which provide protections to criminal defendants and to others, which the Constitution doesn't mandate. The perfect example, for instance, is the statute which now provides that a person who refuses to take a breathalyzer examination may not have that fact used against him in a criminal case. That is not a constitutional rule. You could use the fact that he refused to take a breath test were it not for the fact that the Oregon statute forbids it.
Further questions from the committee?
With respect to the example that you put where the man testified that he was a scoutmaster and so on, having put his character in issue, isn't he then subject to cross-examination with respect to his character?
You're subject to offering impeaching testimony with respect to his general reputation for character, but you may not offer testimony with respect to particular prior bad acts, and that would include the alleged offense he's supposed to have committed.
Except that you could cross-examine him with respect to any prior felonies that he's committed.
Yes, but it doesn't necessarily follow that the individual who's the defendant in this case has a prior record.
That's true, but what I wanted, I didn't want the committee to have the impression that there was no counter to the case that you put.
No, the concern I've got is not with that. It's not that we can't ask him if he's ever been convicted of a crime, a practice which is of dubious value anyway. Sometimes I think it does more harm than good. The point is that the purpose of the trial is to inquire into the truth or falsity of the allegations contained in the charging instrument with respect to this instance. Did he or did he not perform a certain number of acts which constitute an offense under Oregon law? He's beautifully avoided the responsibility for responding to that question, even though he's taken the stand.
But my point is that the prosecution is not left without counters to that that strategy.
Well, with all respect, I disagree. First of all, we are utterly without counters unless the individual has a prior criminal record or unless the manner in which the testimony is offered tends to put his good character in issue. And even if it does, the most we can do is then offer general reputation testimony, if in fact such exists, to the effect that he has a bad general reputation with respect to law-abidingness or whatever. And that may not be true at all. And in the average transient criminal, you couldn't find a community which knows him well enough to offer testimony with respect to what his reputation is within it.
Representative,
it's a very fundamental question, and probably comes from my watching Perry Mason as a youth. But I was under the impression that you could not cross-examine a witness on material that he did not first testify to. Now, how does this legislation address that question?
Right. That's the general rule. And the reason is, with respect to any witness except the defendant himself, the other party can also call that witness with respect to the matters they wish to produce testimony.
You're going too fast.
Okay. Let me back up away. The rule is that unless a witness testifies on direct examination with respect to a proposition or a question, he may not be cross-examined with regard to that. In other words, I testify about X, I can only be cross-examined as to X. I may not be cross-examined as to Y. But if the party that would like to cross-examine as to Y wants this witness to testify about Y, the party is free to call that witness for itself to testify about Y.
So the district attorney could call the defendant
witness. But the district attorney can't call the defendant as a witness. That's
okay.
The one exception to that rule. He can't get
okay.
his hands on the defendant for that purpose. The Fifth Amendment prevents it. And the defendant is really getting the best of both worlds this way. Any other witness, if the defense wanted to call any other witness and limit their testimony to one area, they could do it because it's then within the province of the prosecution to call that witness themselves for other purposes. But you can't do it with respect to the defendant.
Further questions, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Bromka?
This little research I just did indicates that we've had this law on the books for a long, long time. Has this bill ever been introduced before? Is this a new idea? Okay. It seems to go back well into the 20s.
Mm-hmm. That's very old law.
I've got one question. Do you have any statistics on the number of times this trial tract is used in a year?
No, it's called to my attention from time to time, and I don't have at all. In fact, it's impossible to carry statistics of this kind. It's one of those things, you only hear about it when somebody gets snake bit, and usually that snake is long forgotten by the time they've gone to the next trial. So it happens on occasion. It doesn't happen a lot, but I think it happened in the 2 years that I was an active prosecutor, and we're starting to go back in ancient history now, about 7 years ago, I think it happened to me maybe 3 or 4 times in those 2 years. It's very frustrating, and the tactic isn't often used because I think even defense attorneys are unaware that it's available to them, and it takes a certain amount of nerve, a certain amount of chutzpah, I guess, to do it, but it's a beautiful tactic when you do it.
Further questions from the committee? Term
of
life? Yes. Yeah, right.
That's better than a term of art.
I can never pronounce the
I'm back at snake bit. Snake bit.
Further questions? Representative Rutherford?
Yes. Given that the Constitution provides that the defendant cannot be convicted from testimony out of his own mouth, and the notion being that the state has the burden of proving the innocence or the guilt, I should say, without benefit of that kind of testimony, haven't we created an unusual situation where the defendant, if he takes the stand, can be examined without limitation, whereas another witness who is called to take the stand can only be cross-examined with respect to that which he testified?
Yeah, no, I don't think so, for the reasons I've explained at least twice. It seems to me that any other witness is available to either side for whatever purpose they want to put him to, but the defendant isn't. And this simply places, once he's chosen to waive his constitutional right not to testify at all, this simply puts the defendant in the position that any other witness is in. That is to say, his testimony concerning all of the matters which are material to the offense charged is available to whomever wishes to inquire.
Representative
Long. That's true of any other witness in the proceeding now. Puts him in the same position anybody else would be.
Representative Lombard?
I guess I just have kind of a real serious constitutional question about this, and I just don't feel comfortable with it. I'm looking at Section 12 of the Bill of Rights portion, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, and literally, of course, it says, may not be compelled to testify against himself. And what you're saying in your interpretation of this, and I just was scanning the annotations under this section, which there are none that comes to question, that testify against himself means that the minute he takes the stand, for what, regardless of for whatever purpose, he has waived that privilege.
At the trial, yes, sir.
At the trial.
That's the universal constitutional doctrine with respect to that question. And by the way, there are occasions when the decision as to whether or not to exercise that right sometimes conflicts with some other constitutional right. That is to say, if you choose to exercise your right not to testify, then you're jeopardizing some other kind of right, like confrontation. But the U.S. Supreme Court, speaking to that question in Magatha versus Maryland, commented that the fact that a person may have a right to do either of two things, both of which have rise to constitutional levels, does not, by that token alone, forbid requiring him to choose.
I guess I just would like to either see from you or from committee counsel some case authority.
Okay.
Substantiating that. I just don't feel comfortable with it.
Do you want to provide that to Mr.
Yes.
Bronco?
Mr. Bronco, I'll try to
get together.
Work it out between yourselves. Further questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have a note here that the American Civil Liberties Union will present written testimony to the clerk for distribution of the members.
Mr. Chairman,
I imagine they're in favor of this bill.
My name is Nellie Johnson, and I'm an attorney with the Public Defender's Office in Portland. I'm also on the board of the ACLU. I don't have written statements. That's incorrect. I would like to make an oral statement, if I may.
Okay, you'll be permitted to do so this time.
Thank you. Perhaps I should begin by responding to some of the comments that Mr. Gillette has already made. Defense attorneys, I believe, are very much aware of the possibility of calling the defendant to the stand and limiting the questioning. However, there are a number of problems with that. One of the reasons, from my own experience, why defense attorneys would not call a defendant to the stand is that the defendant has a record of some sort, and then the prosecutor could impeach the defendant with that record. That does not look very good in front of a jury. And whether the defendant is asked one question or whether the defendant is asked 10 questions or testifies about the whole matter, the prosecutor would be entitled to ask the question about the past conviction. That's one of the reasons why defense attorneys do not put the defendant on the stand, even to talk about some minor matters. Second, another reason why a defense attorney may not put a defendant on the stand for just commenting on minor things is that the prosecutor may be entitled in final argument to comment on the defendant's failure to talk about the incident. Now, if the defendant does not take the stand, it's error, it's a mistrial if the prosecutor in any way refers to the defendant's failure to take the stand. But once the defendant has taken the stand and fails to testify about certain matters, I'm not sure that there would be a mistrial. It would probably be that the prosecutor could very well argue to the jury that this defendant did not talk about important matters because he may be guilty about those things. I don't know what the answer to that particular statement is. I know for a fact that the failure to take the stand cannot be commented on. It is the position of the American Civil Liberties Union, and I represent them here, as well as the position of the Public Defender's Office, and I've been entitled by the chairman of the board to speak to you today, that this particular bill would be in violation of both the Oregon and United States Constitution. The defendant does have a right not to be compelled to testify against himself, not to be compelled to speak to anyone about the particular matter with which he's charged. Witnesses in general, at this point, under our statutes, can only be cross-examined on matters which have been raised on direct examination. To apply a different rule to the defendant would, in fact, be a denial of equal protection. But the most important part is that a defendant does have the right not to incriminate himself, not to be compelled to testify against himself. If a defendant were to take the stand, answer certain questions, and the prosecutor wished to speak to the defendant about the matter with which he is charged, and the defendant refused to testify to those matters, the only recourse that the judge would have would be to order the defendant to testify about those matters. And if the defendant still refuses to talk about those matters, would be held in contempt. So the defendant, in fact, would be compelled to testify against himself. And that is exactly what the United States Constitution and the Oregon Constitution speak to in dealing with the Fifth Amendment. I think the bill, if enacted, would also have a chilling effect on whether a defendant would take the stand in the first place. There is that particular chilling effect has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court in Simmons versus United States. In a pretrial matter, the defendant asserted another constitutional right, and the Supreme Court has said that once the defendant asserts one constitutional right, that does not mean that he has waived another, which is the Fifth Amendment. I believe there's some recent Oregon decisions which have said the same thing.
Questions from the committee? Representative Lombard.
Well, along the lines of my request to Mr. Gillette, I feel this is a serious enough matter and a significant enough matter that I personally would appreciate having citation of authorities on this with just a very brief, a couple pages.
I'd be more than happy to prepare one.
Representative Ugas?
Doesn't the defendant, in effect, waive his right against the right not to self-incriminate once he takes a stand, with the modification of protection afforded by a statute like this as it presently is?
I don't believe the defendant waives the Fifth Amendment right unless the defendant speaks about the particular matter.
But we are hypothecating a case where he has in fact taken it, but not to testify on the particular crime at issue with which he's charged. It seems to me like he's waived it, if at least to the degree that he's discussed matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the defendant wishes to take the stand on a matter which does not deal specifically with the crime with which the defendant is charged, the defendant is not incriminating himself. But if he's compelled to testify about the particular crime, then he would be compelled to incriminate himself. And we've got the Fifth Amendment.
How do you feel about the thought that we have a situation where this is going to arise where the defendant is charged with a crime, okay? He's not going to take the stand unless he thinks that he can help his cause one way or the other by testifying as to some facts, whatever they may be. How does it strike you that he's allowed under this statute to take the stand and to gain the benefit of whatever he's going to say to help his cause, and yet is not forced to disclose evidence that may be pertinent to his guilt or innocence?
The state of the law, as I understand it, is that the burden of proving someone guilty is on the state, and that proof must be beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant doesn't have to do a thing. The defendant is not required and cannot be required to compel the evidence, to produce the evidence which the state does not have. The state is required to carry its burden of proof, and it must do so without the help of the defendant.
But he's allowed to aid his own cause as much as he wishes, but doesn't have the corresponding obligation to bring forth evidence that might weigh heavily upon his guilt or innocence.
Other witnesses that take the stand can only be cross-examined on matters which are presented on direct examination. But there are various advantages. I don't know exactly how to answer that, but there are various advantages which defendants do have, in a sense, to outweigh the greater advantages which the state has in prosecuting someone. And perhaps the Fifth Amendment is one of those advantages that a defendant has.
Representative Richards.
I've been a little bit disturbed about the comments, some comments and testimony on this subject that seem to imply an assumption of guilt rather than the presumption of innocence. And maybe the presumption of innocence includes that little bit of help that the defendant can take for his case, I don't know, by appearing on the stand as a witness.
Further questions? Representative Blumenauer.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if it'd be possible for whatever authorities are being generated relative to Kip's request, could, if the two don't pass in the night, I guess, I'm wondering if the ACLU and Mr. Gillette, maybe perhaps coordinated by committee staff, they might have a chance to respond so that we make sure that when we do come down to our final action, that they know what the other side is saying and that the full case is presented.
Do you have any objections to that, Mr. Gillette?
No, I'm anxious to have it that way.
Okay. Any further questions from committee? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I would also like an opportunity to speak to House Bill 2171. I came in late and I didn't have a chance to sign up.
Okay, you'll be put on the list.
Thank you very much.
Okay, House Bill 2171, Mr. Gillette.
Excuse me, were we through 2168?
I believe so. Those were the only two witnesses who were scheduled to testify.
Okay, I was going to ask Mr. Gillette if he cared to respond at this time to comments that were just made by the witness.
Mr. Gillette?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Could I make a suggestion to the chair with regard to this? Very frequently, there are only two of us to testify on a measure, and very often it'll be Nellie and I, or Steve House and I, or somebody from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. It might be of value to the committee to hear both of us at the same time. We normally don't hit each other, even though we disagree, and the exchange might be more usefully conducted that way, if the committee wants to do it that way.
Are there any
chairman? No, the chairman allowed this in previous hearing, Mr. Chairman, and it was excellent, I think.
That's fine. We'll do it that way, then, unless there are any objections.
That'd be fine because I would be interested in some responses to these various matters.
And you have some remarks to 2168?
There were only two things that Nellie brought up that really call for comment. One is her point, quite true. We see each other in court fairly frequently, too. One is the comment that any other witness is limited on cross-examination to the matters that the witness discussed on direct. I want to emphasize again, although I did point it out, that any other witness can be called by either side, and therefore that which a side wishes to produce from that witness, they can produce by simply calling him and asking him on direct. And therefore that is a red herring as an argument. And secondly, the question of whether or not someone waives a constitutional right once they take the stand should be understood in this context. If Ms. Johnson's argument were correct, and of course the case citations will ultimately settle that in the minds, I trust, of people here. That's why I'm anxious for both Nellie and I to have a chance to respond to each other's cases, because I know what mine will be, and I think they're better than hers. if I didn't think that, I wouldn't be here. If Ms. Johnson's point were correct, it would mean that a criminal defendant who took the stand could choose to carve out even a section of testimony with respect to the facts which tended to incriminate him. As, for instance, let's say he was involved in a conspiracy to commit a crime, and the substantive crime was committed, and he took the stand and he denied taking part in a series of transactions which related to the conspiracy, but he didn't testify with respect to whether he was present when the substantive crime was actually committed. On her theory, you see, on her theory, he's only testified about those matters, and he doesn't want to testify about the rest, so he can't be cross-examined about the rest. He gets to carve out whatever he pleases. Now, I would submit that to state that proposition is to refute it. The logic of it just won't float. That means the defendant gets to pick. He says, well, with respect to the witness that said I had a red bandana on, I deny that I was wearing a red bandana that day, period. There's three other witnesses having with a blue bandana. He doesn't want to talk about them. That's what the logical extension of that argument would be. And it obviously won't float when you begin to think about it that way.
No, wait, you say that if he says that witness was wrong, I didn't have on a red bandana, that he can't be cross-examined on the issue of a red bandana or the color of a bandana?
No, I'm saying that, and I'm just trying to demonstrate by way of illustration. I'm saying that if once he's taken the stand, it is up to him to carve out, we're speaking for constitutional purposes now only, if once he takes the stand, it's up to him to carve out the area in which he will be required to respond in cross-examination, then waiver becomes an impossible concept to really administer. And the cases simply have never run that way. If a defendant chooses to take the stand, the constitutional block to his being examined is gone, and it needs to be. Because, again, as a reminder, and this is going to come up, I think, every time I appear before the committee or one of its subcommittees, ultimately, the decisions are more and more pointing out the fact that a trial is a process of searching for what the truth is. And while the defendant has certain rights, which he has an absolute right to exercise, such as the right not to take the stand, to sit there and make the state prove every bloody thing and not say a word, waiver, when he takes the stand, means that he has joined the process as a search for truth, and he can be required to go through the process as a search for truth. The game is over, and he has got to take part in the process for the objective purpose for which trials are utilized in our system of justice, just the way anybody else does.
Has there been, Mr. Chairman, have there been, before Ms. Johnson comments on her side of this point, haven't there been some cases where this is taken up as a waiver?
Yeah.
Where you don't have a statute like this?
That's what Representative Lombard's asking for. The answer is yes, and I'll supply them for the committee.
Okay. Has there ever been a case taken up to your knowledge where there is a statute like this?
No, but as I indicated,
to your knowledge.
No, but as I indicated to Mr. Bromka, I didn't do the research, which perhaps I should have done to see how many other states have a parallel.
But you had heard an answer previously that you felt that the state law would prevail in tightening up the problems of the state.
Oh, yeah, the statute.
Getting at the,
right. The statute stands as an inhibition.
Yeah.
The Constitution right now has nothing to do with it because you don't get to the constitutional question. It's the statute which settles the issue.
Can I
first question?
I wonder if you'd respond to Ms. Johnson's comments that the prosecution could refer in final argument that the defendant did not talk about the crime.
Well, you notice she didn't say they could. She says she's afraid they might be able to. She doesn't know. If she were right about the constitutional matters, she couldn't be correct in that because that would be commenting on the exercise of a constitutional privilege, which is forbidden by Griffin versus Illinois and some other cases. If I'm correct with respect to the constitutional theory, then the answer is maybe we could. The fact is we're not permitted to, however. I can tell you that from personal experience. Judges won't allow it because they're not sure either, and so they are going to err on the side of not permitting it. I think as a constitutionally logical matter that you should be able to comment on it. That is to say, the defendant is waived, and therefore what he's chosen to carve out should be subject to comment. But judges don't permit it as a practical matter.
Further questions to the committee? Mr. Bronson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Fugas, the annotations to the ORS list a long series of cases in which the statute was construed to say exactly what it seems to say, that the defendant can only be cross-examined on those matters to which he testified. So there are cases concerning this statute. Answer your question.
Further questions? do you want to make a comment to that, Mrs. Trump?
Just one comment. There is a doctrine which trial judges apply, and that is, I don't know if the title of it is the open door doctrine, but if the defendant, for example, testifies about a red bandana, and that happens to be particularly significant, and it involves a crime with which he's charged, I'm sure that at that point the prosecutor could go into the entire event because the defense attorney has opened the door to that. It's just by, you can divide it by subject matters, but I'm not sure you can take one question and have cross-examination only as to that one question. And that is the problem. That's the reason why the defense attorneys, very much aware of the statute, are not taking advantage of the statute very often because it's very difficult to confine the matters so well that the prosecutor cannot get into other matters which you don't want the client to testify. There is one other comment, and that is, I have never used that. I've been aware of the statute. I've never used it, and I haven't practiced for a very long time either. But most often, both defense attorneys and clients try very hard to have the clients take the stand and testify because, as a practical matter,
juries are more likely to convict someone who doesn't take the stand than someone who takes the stand in his own defense. Even though they're instructed not to use that as an instance, that happens. And so there's any possibility to put a client on to testify, defense attorneys do. And if there is any possibility that the prosecutor would be able to get into matters which the defense attorney doesn't want to get into, most defense attorneys will not take the chance of putting a client on.
Further questions of either witness?
Mr. Chairman, could I know one other thing very quickly? The Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, Nellie is a member of that group, is the best group of young trial lawyers in the state. They may all be aware of this statute. They do not, however, constitute a representative body in terms of the defense bar of this state, for which I'm grateful.
Mike, Mr. Chairman, if I could just one final comment while we're both here. You might, both of you, I'm sure, can agree that in response to Representative Richards' concern that we may seem, some of us may seem to presume guilt, that that certainly isn't in conformance with the presumption in the Anglo-Saxon law. There's a presumption of innocence, no matter how we sound, Sandy.
Representative Richards.
It's just another informational question. Can you apply different rules for the breadth of cross-examination to different types of witnesses and still, you said that constitutional argument.
Yes, you can.
Of equal protection did not apply.
No, it doesn't.
Why?
Because the criminal defendant is in a unique position and therefore the state legislature's decision to treat him separately for purposes of cross-examination bears a rational relationship to an unusual category. No problem.
Okay. But on the other hand, if the defendant is required, or would be required, to testify further than the direct testimony, that is, the prosecutor can inquire into other matters, while defense attorney is not allowed to go into those matters with state's witnesses, then there is an equal protection problem.
There would be if that were so, but the defense attorney is not prevented from doing so. He simply makes the witness his own witness for the purposes of those inquiries, and he gets to go into them.
He wouldn't be overruled for going into an area that wasn't presented on direct?
No, there'd be two different ways of doing it. He'd either be permitted during the cross-examination when he got into a collateral matter. The trial judge controls this. He'd either be permitted at that point to inquire into the other matters, and the jury would be told it's the defense witness for these purposes. It's up to the judge whether or not to permit it then, or he can call the witness later as his own witness to fill in the blanks. But either way, he's permitted to do it. If I were a trial judge, by and large, I think I'd probably require him to do it in his own case, but judges are vested with discretion to permit it at either time, depending on how they think the trial's flowing. But the point is the defendant can get that information from any other witness. And in fact, that's the other reason equal protection doesn't apply. In fact, you're putting the defendant in the very same posture as everybody else, so the protection or the posture or the status of all witnesses becomes, in fact, equal rather than unequal.
Moving along to House Bill 2087. Mr. Gillette, you're on the witness. Both of you are on this bill, so if you wanted to stay there.
Is this 2171?
Right. Mr. Gillette, do you want to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 2171 raises a policy question of dandy dimensions. The civil compromise statute, which is a part of our criminal procedure code, permits a criminal defendant to compromise certain offenses by agreeing with the complaining witness to take care of whatever problem the complaining witness has. Essentially, let's say we've got a larceny and he agrees to make restitution. And then the court is informed of that and the matter is dismissed. Under the Oregon law as it is construed at the present time, within the parameters in which compromise is permitted, the decision of the defendant and the victim to compromise is binding, and the state has no voice in the matter. What this means, as a matter of practice, is that, let's say, in a fraudulent check case, the state will have gone to the trouble of finding the defendant, calling him before the bar of justice, conducting the investigation to establish that this is the fellow who wrote those checks and or used that fraudulent credit card. And then the defendant will come forward with enough money just prior to trial to compromise the matter out, and the state is not permitted to stop it. The measure as proposed to you would have two effects. It would provide that compromise is available in a more limited number of cases than has heretofore been true. Right now, compromise is available with respect to the Class B felony of criminal activity and drugs, all Class C felonies, and all misdemeanors. The limitation proposed by this statute would reduce its availability to misdemeanors or the violation of ORS 411-630 is a welfare fraud statute. I'm trying to remember exactly which one. That's the one felony it would apply to. And it would also require that the district attorney had to consent. Now, the reason I'm concerned about that provision particularly is that if the district attorney is not permitted on behalf of the people of this state to exercise some kind of control over the benefit to the public or the harm to the public which results from a person being able to compromise a case this way, wealthy defendants will be able to buy themselves out of criminal offenses, including Class C felonies, without the people of this state being protected at all. The remarkable thing about the statute as it operates is that it tends to work more beneficially for well-off defendants than for others. In fact, I'm amazed, although Nellie hasn't gotten around to it yet, I think she will eventually, I'm amazed that the Public Defender's Office has not argued that, in fact, the statute constitutes an equal protection problem, because those people who are indigent can't buy their way out. Keep looking for that case, hasn't come along yet. I think maybe Nellie's clients are finding enough money to buy their way out anyway. But the point is that a wealthy criminal defendant is in a much better position to buy his way out, and there's absolutely nothing at the moment we can do about it.
One of the prerogatives of having the gavel, I guess, is you can ask the questions first. First of all, as I read the statute, it says the crime may be compromised. Don't we already have some guarantees that the trial judge, who does represent the state and the people, he has to agree to accept the compromise, Mr. Gillette?
He does, but the point is that, in the first place, I don't agree that he represents the state and the people, and I don't think he does either. I think he thinks he's supposed to sit there and be neutral. And if he's got a case he can get off of his docket, he'll take that.
Well, he has to be elected by the people.
Yeah, but Representative Gardner, if you really think the people of the state elect judges with some understanding of what their history of performance on the bench has been, I would submit that that's a mistaken assumption.
Also, wouldn't the judge take into consideration what the district attorney's position on compromise might be?
In our experience, they tend not to.
Could you delineate for the committee some crimes that are Class C felonies that would not be compromisable that are presently compromisable?
I gave a list to the committee yesterday of Class C felonies in another context. I could dig up another set of copies of that list of offenses, but
that letter that you gave us?
Yes, that's a list of Class C felonies, because that question there involved similar concerns.
Is it your position that there should never be a situation where a Class C felony could be compromised, or the interest of justice might not require that?
Oh, I think you've got to make that judgment. I am not sure that drawing the line at the misdemeanor is a matter of towering moment. If you want to draw the line as it's presently drawn, but provide that the district attorney will have the opportunity to prevent it, that is to say, he must consent, I'd feel that that was a far more progressive step than to approach it the other way. It's not the compromise itself or the ability to compromise itself so much that I'm bothered about, although that worries me, because it frankly bothers me that wealthy defendants are in a better position to take care of this. I really do have an equal protection question about it. It's not that that bothers me so much, but it's the fact that the one person who's charged with trying to determine the impact of this question on the public, and whose business it was to try to put the case together to establish that the public interest had been harmed and a case could be proved, is not able to exercise his authority in this area. That's the that's the genuine concern,
for
the strongest concern.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Richards.
Does the District Attorney's Association have a victim restitution bill in discussion, and how do you see the concept of victim restitution relating to this bill?
I haven't had a chance to study the victim restitution bill that is in, that was offered by the Governor's Task Force on Corrections, thoroughly enough to be certain that I understand it. The impression I got was that it was limited to crimes of violence.
No.
And I read it at 2 in the morning, so I can't claim my impression is very accurate. But in any event, the district attorneys do not have a separate bill, and we intended all along to leave the matter to the Task Force on Corrections for establishing whatever program appeared to the legislature to be appropriate and something that could be funded.
I guess my question is, part of it is that while we haven't adopted HDR 4 yet or any form of proposed constitutional amendment or recommendation to the floor, and maybe this doesn't relate, and I wish you'd tell me if it didn't, but right now we call for reformation and not vindictive justice, and we're discussing the concept of victim restitution, and I don't see how this bill furthers either of those two basic philosophies.
Right. I don't think it furthers reformation at all to permit certain classes of individuals who violate the law to be under the impression that the worst that they face is a requirement that they buy their way out of it if they're caught.
Reimburse the victim for
his loss.
Thank you.
Representative Rutherford.
Would you be satisfied, rather than with the word consent, with the word, with giving notice to the district attorney?
No, because the district attorney gets notice now. That doesn't do him any good, because he's got no ability to stop it if the judge is determined to clear his docket or for any other reason wants to agree to it. And quite frankly, Representative Rutherford, the reasons judges consent run all the way from the absolutely meritorious decision that the interests of justice are furthered by the compromise to the far more common decision that, well, it gets another case off my docket.
Further questions? Representative Lombard.
Well, Mr. Gillette, wouldn't some of the prosecutors really be in the same position, too? In other words, aren't you just transferring this authority from the court? Prosecutor, and the prosecutor's got a big backlog of cases, and it's in his interest to dispose of this particular case, regardless of the wealth.
I think he might very well take that into consideration. But keep in mind, and this is the point I want to make, keep in mind that he is in a position in looking at the situation to examine the background of the defendant and the man's prior history with respect to criminal offenses, and I think in a better way than the judge is. And he also is able to determine, at least I think he's able to determine, in the same way he determined whether or not to prosecute the matter in the first place, whether or not the way this crime was committed and what this man did looks like the sort of thing that needs to be prosecuted in order to fulfill his own functions. And far more than the judge, the public is aware of what the DA does, and he will be called to book for those things which the public thinks he shouldn't have done. He at least is subject to criticism in the press in a manner in which the press is never willing to criticize the judiciary or the trial bench or the appellate bench.
Doesn't the district attorney have the opportunity to present all that background evidence to the judge?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Very frequently the disclosure that a compromise agreement has been reached occurs about 2 minutes before the matter is to go to trial. So the DA is not prepared to go at the thing that way. He's got a couple of witnesses sitting around with respect to what actually occurred. But if he's going to try to demonstrate with 14 witnesses what the man's prior criminal history has been and what problems he represents in the community, he's not ready to do that. And the judge, again, he's got a case for trial, he wants to get rid of it. It's an understandable human instinct, but it's not a very good way to run the system.
Representative Lombard?
Let me touch on another aspect of this bill. You've added the words here, the violation of ORS 411-639. I believe you said you thought that was a welfare type case.
It's a welfare fraud statute.
Is that welfare type case not covered today under the compromise statute?
It is not, because the way the statute is worded now, it applies only to the criminal code, and that statute is outside the criminal code, and so you can't compromise it as it stands now. There may be some judges who are doing it, but they don't have the statutory authority to do so. Oh, no.
Do you think it would be good public policy, regardless of what we did with your consent factor, to add the welfare case to that type of case that could be civilly compromised?
In other words, you're going to do an even bigger number on me than it's being done now? Yes, I think so. As a matter of equity, I think it should be included. Whatever the availability of compromise is, that ought to be included.
Any further questions to the witness? Mrs. Johnson or Ms. Johnson? Whichever.
Ms. Johnson?
Ms. Johnson.
That might be simpler. I will start by responding to some of the things that Mr. Gillette said. CAID is the only Class B felony which can be treated as a misdemeanor. And criminal activity and drugs, excuse me. And I do not believe it is possible to civilly compromise a CAID case. There has been no attempt to do so because there is no remedy at civil law where you have a criminal possession of a drug. There is no one that you can sue for anything other than police officers, and police officers are excluded specifically from the statute, from the coverage of the statute. You cannot civilly compromise a case with a police officer. So I think that it's academic to discuss the Class B felony at this point. We're only talking, as the statute applies, about Class C felonies that are punishable as misdemeanors and all other misdemeanors. The statute eliminates Class C felonies from the possibility of a civil compromise. Some of the Class C felonies there's a theft one, which the difference between a theft one and a theft two is the amount, the value of the property. If it's more than $200, it becomes a felony. If it's less, it's a misdemeanor. Unauthorized use of a motor vehicle is another one of those Class C felonies that can be compromised. What that means is if someone, for example, you could have a passenger in a car who becomes aware at some point while the driver is driving that the car has been stolen and has an opportunity to leave and doesn't leave. So the passenger has the opportunity, if the owner of the car wishes to do so, to compromise the case. We're not talking necessarily about money agreements, money compromises. We're not necessarily talking about paying off the victim. In most civil compromises, we are talking about community service work with indigents. That is most often what the victims want the person to do. Many of the cases that do end up being civilly compromises are neighborhood squabble situations that shouldn't be in the court room in the first place because it's expensive and it gives someone a criminal record, and where the neighbors just want to settle everything out of court. Then one of the requirements usually imposed on a defendant charged with harassment or what, you know, Class B misdemeanor, is that he does some community service work to compensate the community for all the trouble that he's caused. The procedure in a civil compromise is that the documents are served on the district attorney. There's a hearing scheduled before a judge, and it's usually not the trial judge. It's the chief judge, either in misdemeanor court or in felony court, and that judge does not worry about his trial docket because he isn't trying cases. Both sides present their position, that is, the defense attorney and the prosecutor present their position to the judge, presumably the prosecutor informing the judge that this is a crime that should not be civilly compromised because it's so atrocious that the defendant has a record and it should not be accepted. In most situations, from my experience, judges will not accept civil compromises unless the district attorney agrees anyway. It's a very rare situation where judges rule otherwise. There aren't that many civil compromises anyway. The objection which Public Defender's Office would have and the American Civil Liberties Union has to this bill is that it takes away the inherent power and authority which the judge has, and it gives it to the district attorney. In effect, it does away with a civil compromise. If the district attorney had taken the trouble to charge a case, the district attorney is not very likely to agree to throw it out, unless it was a bad case to start with.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bugis.
Would you be in favor of this bill if we substituted for the words district attorney a judge?
That's fine. That's fine.
It gives you a third party to the compromising, which seems to be part of what Mr. Gillette's up for.
Isn't that
what would you feel?
It is a state.
But I think that is the present law.
That is the present law. The judge makes the decision.
Well, I thought they could do it without even the consent of any member of the court.
No, the judge must approve the settlement, the compromise.
The law, well, wait a minute.
And the thrust of it is that the judge and the district attorney must approve.
Representative Longbottom.
Well, I wanted to ask Mr. Gillette this question as a practical matter. I've been aware that this law has been on the books for a long time, and in practice, I'm afraid that it has been limited to just those cases that Ms. Johnson is mentioning, usually where we have a neighborhood-type squabble. I've seldom been able to get most serious complaining witnesses to go along with it. As a practical matter, Nick, how often is it used? Do you have any feeling for that?
The funny thing is it's used a lot in some counties and almost never in others.
Really?
And I think that's partly a reflection of the attitude of the courts in those counties, and it's partly a reflection of the kinds of crimes that tend to be committed. As you may or may not be aware, for instance, there are certain counties in which homicide is far more common crime than
I
theft.
I represent one of those.
You're from one of you're from one of those counties. Douglas being the other one. It's a little difficult to generalize because patterns of crime very literally differ from county to county, and so does the manner in which the defense bar conducts itself, the prosecution conducts itself, and the court treats these matters. For instance, Nellie's example of the fine and systematic way in which Multnomah County deals with applications is fine, but it's not representative of the way things are done around the state. I wish it were. For instance, they can afford the luxury of having a presiding judge in both criminal and civil court in district and circuit courts. A lot of places, it's just one judge doing it all.
Mr. Gillette, have you had an opportunity to read the testimony in opposition to House Bill 2171 submitted by...
No.
You haven't?
No.
Let me read this paragraph to you, and I'd like to get your comments to it. We submit that it is not good policy or fundamentally fair to allow an advocate such as the prosecutor to make the decision of approving or disapproving a civil compromise. Just as it is not good policy to allow the district attorney to impose a sentence upon a conviction. It is the function of the prosecutor and defense attorney to make recommendations and take advocate positions. It is not expected that they make unbiased decisions.
I could modify that slightly by making the following argument. We submit it's not good policy or fundamentally fair to allow an advocate, such as the prosecutor, to make the decision on deciding whether or not a case ought to be charged as a criminal offense. The district attorney's line of work, Mr. Gardner.
Well, it's his decision to charge.
That's right.
But the court has the power to dismiss or to override the prosecutor's decision.
Not
he
really. Not in any meaningful sense. The decision to charge is really the prosecutor's decision.
Granted, he can bring forth the prosecution, but if the court does not want that prosecution to proceed, it shall not proceed. The court can dismiss.
Well, I'm trying to think of how many cases I've faced in which the prosecutor and the judge were at loggerheads with respect to whether or not the prosecutor was going to get to try his case. I can only recall a couple. The prosecutor wins in those situations. Sometimes it requires mandamus to get the judge permitted to go ahead, but it's the prosecutor's decision, not the judge's.
Well, my point is that basically you have two advocates, okay? You're basically making a decision that's going to affect both the defendant and the victim of the crime. And who is better to make that decision? Someone who speaks from a position of neutrality or someone who has a biased viewpoint?
Well, what we're talking to here, since the DA does not have a veto, is essentially a situation in which one side's powerless. The other side comes forward and says, I want this done. It amounts to an ex parte representation. The DA can squawk all he pleases, but he can't stop it.
But only if the judge decides to approve it.
Mm-hmm. As I indicated, the process in some places is simply to buy it if it's offered. In other places, it is not.
Further questions?
I'm not claiming that that's persuasive. I'm just telling you that's what, as I said when I started this is a policy question you're going to have to decide.
Further questions from the committee? Mr. Prompt?
I have one question just to clarify something Ms. Johnson said. I believe you said that in most cases, as a practical matter, the judge won't dismiss unless the DA agrees. You also said that the DA that went to the bother of charging the crime won't agree. So the conclusion is that compromise doesn't happen, but that's not the case because you're defending compromise. So how does that fit together?
Civil compromises occur not very often. And in my experience, they have become more and more rare. For example, in Festus situations, big stores have a policy of not compromising those cases. Often enough, the district attorney will go along with a civil compromise with a very weak case. The judges in Multnomah County will usually not agree to endorse a civil compromise and dismiss a case unless the district attorney agrees with it. But there are some special situations, some special cases, in which the defense attorney and the prosecutor disagree, and the victim happens to be one of those that does not wish to prosecute because things have been settled. And those are the circumstances where you need an impartial person to make that decision. All the facts are being presented to the judge by both sides, and it's for that reason that we have judges to reach those kinds of decisions.
So you're saying that this statute doesn't have much of an application, but to the extent it has any application at all, you wouldn't want it altered to give the DA a more powerful role or more meaningful role?
That's correct. I can give an example of why that may do away with civil compromise. In Multnomah County, there used to be a diversion program, and we used to look at it as the poor man's civil compromise. It was an opportunity not to have a criminal record, to be diverted to doing some community service work, and then the charge would be dismissed. That was interpreted to be completely within the power of the district attorney. It was a program which the district attorney initiated. At this point, it doesn't exist anymore. The last time I appeared in misdemeanor court, which was approximately 6 or 7 months ago, the only time the diversion was allowed was in minor in possession cases, which is no longer a crime anyway, it's a violation. I have not heard of a diversion having occurred. It occurs very rarely. And what I'm saying is that if that discretion is left exclusively within the power of the various district attorneys, that discretion may become non-existent.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you both.
Mr. Chairman, I noticed the rapid approach of the hour at 3 o'clock, and we were all invited to see the Ways and Means Committee at 3, and I'd hate to miss that.
Well, we've got one more bill. We have only one witness on that bill.
Guess who?
Who could that be?
Yeah. I think the fireworks and Ways and Means will probably be going on for some time. I think if we hurry, we could probably finish our business and get there.
Good.
If we can keep the questions to a minimum and move right along. Okay, House Bill 2173, Mr. Gillette.
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, the purpose of this bill is extremely simple. It's to upgrade every offense which involves the actual interference with the process of the trial process by tampering with witnesses or by a witness himself tampering with the process by committing perjury. It just appears to us as a policy matter, now that we've had 6 years to work under the criminal code, that all the penalties are just one level too low. Perjury is not serious enough at this point, and the other offenses kind of follow along in a natural sequence. Perjury really ought to be a Class B felony. It's very difficult to imagine a more serious attack on the way the system operates than the intentional false swearing to procure a result in a court.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Bronka.
For the committee's information, I think you ought to have some idea of the time span in terms of sentence that you're dealing with. If you increase perjury to a Class B felony from a Class C, the sentence would go from the maximum possible sentence. We go from 5 years to 10 years. Class A misdemeanor up to C felony is 1 year up to 5 years. So in properly judging the proper penalty for these crimes, you've got to keep that in mind.
What is it? Run through them again. What is?
Okay. Class C felony, 5 year maximum. Class B felony, 10 year maximum. Class A misdemeanor, 1 year maximum. Class C felony, 5 years maximum. It's a big jump. Further questions from the committee? Representative Lombard.
Seems to me that this is one of those areas where you really have the penalties in here for a deterrence effect. At least I think more so than many other areas, where there's a real emphasis, a real feeling, a real desire for deterrence. Do you feel that in the four-year experience that you've had with these provisions now, that, for instance, perjury presently being a Class C felony, that is not acting as much as a deterrent as it should be? How do you tell?
Well, my observation, the way I'd answer that is to say that I judge the way a statute is working in part by the way judges are implementing it. That is to say, what do they do with it? And I get to see a fair amount of this because, as you're probably aware, I'm responsible for all criminal appeals in Oregon. So I see the results of perjury trials. Judges tend to push defendants to the wall in sentencing on these kinds of offenses. And the indication, and I'm speaking from a general impression, but just the judge's comments with respect to how frustrated they are with the fact the individual did this and so on, and very frequently the judge has been made aware of the fact that another case was lost or dismissed or something else because of the perjury that was involved. The judge's reaction is very frequently, "I just wish I had the room to sentence you to more," because it's such a fundamental attack on the ability of the system to work. There's virtually nothing that can be done about a lie. It only takes one lie to, not just a criminal case, but one lie to destroy any kind of proceeding, so that a just result is not reached. You might just as well burn down the courthouse.
On your false swearing, this includes all documents, too, does it not?
Yeah.
Including in the commercial law today, moving towards a lot of more false swearing provisions for notaries.
Yeah, I think mistakenly so. I would feel more comfortable speaking about the law generally with respect to false swearing if we didn't require so many oaths.
Yeah.
But prosecutions here usually occur with respect to false swearing with respect to documents, let's say concerning obtaining a license to practice medicine or something of that sort, where you've really substantially misrepresented a pretty important, a pretty significant matter. And the likelihood here of the sentences being as high is less unless the misrepresentation is very substantial. But while you're talking about licensing, you have a whole gamut of things from relatively minor, "I swear this is true" kind of
mm-hmm.
situations to really some very, very severe ones.
Like I said, I'm a little bit concerned about that segment of it because we have moved into the out of the criminal law area, really, and out of the trial area into using the false swearing provision on so many commercial documents in so many areas that I feel it's pretty important. People know what they are swearing to, but it's practical.
I understand that. From a purely personal point of view, I feel much more strongly about the perjury, and I am inclined to regard perjury as not a step up from false swearing. It is a different breed of animal, or it tends to be. It's a direct assault on the whole ability of the criminal justice process or the justice process to operate.
Further questions from the committee?
What was the penalties before the new code came into effect for these crimes here?
You know, I can't recall. I thought that perjury was a 10-year felony, but I can't recall for sure. I'm sorry, I don't remember. I didn't bring my old book with me.
Don't
you feel tampering is almost in the same category as perjury? You feel perjury?
I think tampering and perjury are more serious than false swearing, because both of them, as I say, are a direct assault on the actual process of adjudicating something. I think tampering ought to be a Class C felony. I am not so sure about false swearing. I understand that in drawing these, I'm not asked. It's not always my personal opinion that the district attorneys adopt.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, would the false swearing also apply to such things as notary, false oath in notary cases?
As I recall, yes, Representative Dugas. Yes.
false notarization, and that's the point that Representative Lombard is making, and it's the point that makes me feel a little uncomfortable. And the reason I feel a lot better about tampering with a witness or perjury, because it's an awfully clear event.
Financial statement of the bank is usually placed on the bottom
sign. Oh, it says I certify. That's different. That's not chargeable.
That's not
that's not a sworn document.
Well, it's not in conjunction with the judicial process, for one thing. It's just a commercial process.
Any further questions from the committee?
Just a second, Mr. Dugas' comment, though. 162 is a general criminal statute, isn't it?
Yes.
And so if you happen to have a commercial document or a bank document that...
Or it's notarized?
Notarized, or you threw in... swearing language, I question whether you might not be bringing it into that category.
I would agree to leave it. Well, discussion.
Any further questions to the witness? Okay, that closes the public hearing. Is there any desired committee action in the form of recommendation of the full committee? We'll start with House Bill 2173.
Mr. Chairman, I move to amend that section 2 at line 11, to delete the amendment, leave it at this class table.
Okay, with a...
What's that? Do you remember what that is?
1 year.
1 year.
One year. Yeah, that's
class table.
To me, that feels better.
Okay, if I state your motion correctly, it's your motion that we pass this on with a recommendation, do pass to the full committee with the idea that the full committee amend false swearing to leave it to be a Class A misdemeanor.
Right.
Okay.
And otherwise, pass the bill on, in other words, pass the bill as then amended.
All those in favor of the motion will signify by saying aye. All those opposed to it will signify by saying nay. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dugas? Representative Lombard?
Aye.
Representative Richards?
Nay.
Representative Rutherford?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye. So ordered. Okay, House Bill 2171.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards?
I'd like to make a motion that we delete if the district attorney consents from line 7. And forward House Bill 2171 to full subcommittee.
Okay.
Do pass.
Okay, the motion has been stated that we recommend to the full committee that the language, if the district attorney consents in line 7, be deleted, and the bill as amended, that the subcommittee recommends that the bill in that form be do pass by the full committee. All those in favor of the motion will signify by saying aye. All those opposed will signify by saying nay. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bugis?
Aye.
Representative Lombard?
Aye.
Representative Richards?
Aye.
Representative Rutherford?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Nay. So ordered. House Bill 2168. I would not entertain a motion on this. I think it's the consensus of the committee that we get the case law on it. I think that it along with the case law should be sent to the full committee for further action.
Mr. Chairman, yes. You don't want it to come back to the subcommittee. You want it to go on to the full committee, but with more.
Yeah. House Bill 2165.
Mr. Chairman, before you leave there, both parties will submit some case law on this.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, in connection with 2165, I move that we send it on to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. The motion is that we send House Bill 2165 onto the full committee with a due pass recommendation. All those in favor will signify by saying aye. All those opposed will signify by saying nay. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bugis?
Aye.
Representative Lombard?
Aye.
Representative Richards? Aye. Representative Rutherford.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye. So ordered. House Bill 2164 and 2166 will be held over. Be heard with 2167. We'll stand adjourned.
Okay.